The words to which I should like to call your attention this evening are to be found in Paul's epistle to the Ephesians in chapter 6, and reading again verses 18, 19, and 20. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, and watching thereunto with all perseverance and supplication for all saints, and for me, that utterance may be given unto me, that I may open my mouth boldly to make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in bonds, that therein I may speak boldly as I ought to speak. Now, we've been spending a number of Sunday nights here considering the message of the Christian gospel. We do this not simply because we are a church, and because it's expected of us to do this. The church was brought into being in order that she might preach this gospel, and that is her function and her task, to make known the content of this great and glorious gospel. Never was there greater need in the world for this. There is a gospel at all because of the need of the world, but never was there perhaps a greater need than just at this present time. Now, the way in which we are approaching the subject can be put like this, that of all the confusion that characterizes the thought of modern men, all the confusion that characterizes life in so many ways and departments at the present time, there is none which is at one and the same time more obvious and more tragic than the confusion with respect to the nature of the gospel, the business of the gospel, the message of the gospel. And it is because of that confusion that I'm thus devoting a number of Sunday evenings to this great question. It's almost incredible that this should be necessary with an open Bible before us. But alas, men don't take their ideas from the Bible. They have their own notions as to what a gospel is, and thus confusion is created. Now, the New Testament itself has many, many descriptions of the gospel. We've been looking at quite a number of them. And then we came on last Sunday night to look at the particular one that is to be found here in this 19th verse of this 6th chapter of Paul's epistle to the Ephesians, where the apostle says that he hopes that they will pray for him in Ephesus in order that he may be enabled to make known the mystery of the gospel, and that he may do so with boldness as he ought to speak. And we began considering this extraordinary description of the gospel last Sunday night, the mystery of the gospel. And what we saw in essence can be put like this, that man has always stumbled at this particular aspect of the gospel. I showed you how there are modern movements which tried to do away with the element of mystery altogether. But in addition to that, the New Testament itself tells us that the gospel has always come to people as a surprise. The announcement even came to Mary, who had the great honor of bearing our Lord in her womb. It was even a mystery to her. She stumbled at it. She couldn't understand it. And so it was with the great religious leaders of the Jews at the time. It's always been a stumbling block because it isn't what people thought it was going to be. They've never understood this whole point about the mystery of the gospel. But the gospel itself says that it is a mystery. And we saw that there is no way perhaps in which this element of mystery comes out more clearly than in this, that the wise and prudent don't understand it, that to the clever, the philosophers, the Greeks, the gospel has always been foolishness. They make nothing of it. They dismiss it. And yet, at the same time, it is a gospel, it is a message that can help the most ignorant people, has got something to say to children. Now, this is one of the great enigmas of this gospel. The whole element of mystery comes out here, that it baffles the understanding of the wise, and yet those who are without gifts and propensities can obtain an understanding of it. That is, of course, because it is a revelation. Now, we ended therefore by saying that it's inevitable that this gospel should be a mystery. Why? Well, because it's God's wisdom. Not men's, but God's mind, God's wisdom, God's plan with respect to the world. And it's also a mystery because man, as he is by nature, his mind is dulled and his understanding is dimmed. And put these two things together, and it's not surprising that the gospel is a mystery. Well, now, there you are. There it is, looking at it very, very generally. That's what we did last Sunday night. But I indicated that we couldn't leave it at that, that we would go on to consider the mystery of the gospel in certain particular respects. Because in every one of these respects, mankind has always stumbled at the mystery and is still doing so, even until this present hour. Now, I want to consider, therefore, one of these particular aspects of the mystery of the gospel with you this evening. And the particular one that we are to consider tonight is one, of course, that is suggested to us quite inevitably by this particular day. This day has become known, we've all come to call it, Remembrance Sunday. It's the day in which the minds of men and women turn to the two horrible, terrible world wars that we've already had in this century, and to the taking away by death in the cruelty of war of so many young lives and other lives. This is the day on which the world, I say, considers this great question, this great problem. This is Remembrance Sunday. And it raises, therefore, in an acute manner, I think you'll all agree, what we may describe as the mystery of God's ways with respect to this world and its life. Now, that is our subject. The mystery of the gospel, yes, the mystery of the gospel in particular, with regard to God's ways with respect to this world. Now, I think you'll agree again that there is nothing which so frequently perplexes the natural man, the man who's not a Christian, and causes him to stumble as just this very question. Man shows that he doesn't understand this mystery or this aspect of the mystery. He shows it by the questions that he asks. I shall be referring to them in a moment. The questions he puts. He shows it by the arguments that he uses. I'll be able to show you that he contradicts himself, he's inconsistent with himself. This is all because he's face to face with a mystery, something that he doesn't understand. He's in a state of complete confusion. Indeed, I'm emboldened to say this, that man as he is by nature, without the light of this gospel and without the light of the Holy Spirit in his own mind, I make bold to say that man is wrong at all points and in every respect when he comes to this subject of God's dealings with this world and God's relationship to it. And yet, the whole thing is really revealed to us here in the gospel. It's all here in the Bible, open before us. Now, let me add one qualification to that. When I say that it's all open to us here, I mean that there is everything that we need by way of understanding. There are residual matters which no one understands. There are certain things, obviously, that we are not meant to understand. There are certain things which I would say, by definition, are beyond our understanding. The book of Deuteronomy in chapter 29 has this great statement. It says, the hidden things belong unto God, but the things which are revealed, they belong unto us and to our children. Now, that's a great text always to bear in mind when you're dealing with this particular subject. The secret things belong unto the Lord our God. But those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. Very well. Now then, let's look at this great problem together. Don't forget our definition of what is meant by mystery. The mystery of the gospel, says Paul. What does mystery mean in the New Testament? It means this. It is the way of describing truth which is beyond the natural understanding of men. It is the way of describing something that is essentially in and of itself a complete mystery. but which, in the gospel, God has graciously chosen to reveal and to make plain to us. That's what mystery means. It doesn't mean something vague or nebulous or indefinite. It means something that is inscrutable and unattainable to the natural mind of men, but which God has revealed to us by his Spirit. Now, those who may not have been here last Sunday night and who want an extended statement about that, have just to read the second chapter of Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians, and there you will find it in extenso. Paul says that he's preaching the hidden wisdom, God's wisdom, even that hidden wisdom which God hath ordained before the world unto our glory. And he says, the eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither hath it entered the heart of men, the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. Mystery to the natural men, but God hath revealed them. That's the definition of mystery. Things that are hidden to the natural, to the wise and prudent, but which God has revealed and made plain by the word of the gospel, by the power of the Spirit, to those who are ready to become as little children and to receive it. Now then, what is all this to say with regard to this particular problem of Remembrance Sunday? The teaching is this. The first statement with regard to this problem, which is made by the gospel, is that it and it alone has an explanation of this world's ills. That's our starting point, isn't it? Why is the world as it is? Why do we have such a thing as Remembrance Sunday? Why have we ever had these wars? Why are the nations piling up armaments? Why is there all this discussion and argumentation and disputation about these types of weapons and who's to use them? What's it all about? How has it come to pass? There's our basic problem. I take it that you all agree with me that that is the basic problem. My dear friends, I know you haven't come here tonight just to have a little soothing syrup, for me to say just some sweet nothings to you and make you feel happier while you're here. I'm sure that you're concerned about understanding the problem, and this is where the gospel is unique. It doesn't merely medicate symptoms, it gets down to the causes. It's concerned about an ultimate explanation. And I'm saying that it claims that it and it alone has an adequate and a radical explanation of the state and the condition of the world and why there is such a thing as war and all that follows with it. In other words, if I may put it in a different way, the claim of the gospel is this, that world history is an absolute proof of the case of the Bible. I will put that in contemporary terms. The whole state and condition of the world at this very moment is proving the biblical case to the very hilt. Now, I'm quite certain that when I say that, there are some people present even in this congregation, leave alone the masses that are outside the church and who have never heard the gospel in their lives, who think that a man who can say a thing like that in 1964... well, must be what a well-known politician, not to say a notorious one, I think has described as being bonkers. Fancy saying in 1964 that the modern state of the world is a proof of the case of the Bible. The thing sounds so utterly ridiculous and idiotic, doesn't it? And yet I'm concerned to prove this to you. And it doesn't take any difficulty at all. It's one of the easiest things I've ever had to do. Let me show you what I mean. Let's first of all ask this question. Why are things as they are? Let's ask people who don't believe the Bible, who don't believe the gospel. Let's ask them. And, of course, it really comes to this. This is all they can say. The more honest ones admit that they're baffled and that they're really bewildered. They don't understand. I've quoted so often from this pulpit statements by people like the late Mr. H.G. Wells and others, and that great classical scholar and professor at Oxford, Professor Gilbert Murray. These men were humanists of various types. and how they frankly admitted that the last war really left them in a state of complete bewilderment. Professor Gilbert Murray had been president, I think, of the League of Nations Union. He'd given the last years of his great life to the propagation of that teaching, and he was quite confident after the First World War that this was the thing that was going to banish war. And there were many others who thought exactly the same. But you see, the war, Second War, came, and they were shattered. They couldn't explain it, they couldn't understand it. But in general, we can put it like this, and quite fairly. The common belief is, of course, that the world is advancing and developing. It's the evolutionary idea. That's the basis of modern thought. The world has been thinking like that now for just over 100 years. The whole thing became popular with Darwin's book in 1859, The Origin of Species. It was made popular by T.H. Huxley and by Herbert Spencer and people like that, and it has been the basic assumption of the average man. It is, I say, that the world is gradually evolving towards perfection. Well, then you say to them, how do you explain this century? And there's only one explanation they can give you. It's a kind of evolutionary lag. Just a temporary regression. Something that's just gone wrong for the moment. That's the nearest they can get. The fact is, they don't know. They don't understand. It doesn't fit in with the pattern. The whole thing has become a problem and an enigma. Very well. Over and against that is the explanation given by the mystery of the gospel, the message of the Bible. What is it? Well, here it is. This is the great theme of the Bible. You know, the Bible is a book which is meant to explain life to us. I know there's a lot of history in it and all the rest of it, geography and so on. All right, but what's it there for? Well, it's there simply because this is all part and parcel of the great problem of life and of living and of salvation. That's what the Bible's about. It isn't an encyclopedia of general knowledge. It is a very specialist book. And it's a book that specializes upon the condition of men and the only way of salvation. That's the great theme of the Bible from beginning to end. It's the book of salvation. So it starts very rightly by telling us why we need salvation, the cause of all our troubles. What is it? Now, it is the Bible alone that teaches this. And that is why I am saying that it is the Bible alone that really has a message to give to us on this Remembrance Sunday night. What's the cause of the trouble? Well, did you hear my reading from the 6th chapter of the Epistle to the Ephesians? Finally, my brethren, says the apostle in a postscript to these people at Ephesus, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that he may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood. He says, you know, life is a wrestling match. Life is a great fight. We are struggling against evil powers. They're grappling with us, and we have to grapple with them to save ourselves. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. Our problem is not with man, not my own flesh and blood, nor somebody else's flesh and blood. Of course, we've got a fight there. But he says the real essence of our problem isn't there. He says if you think that your problem is only your own nature and the nature of other people with whom you have to live and who are always so difficult, whereas you are so perfect, he says you're all wrong. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. Well, what do we wrestle against? Oh, he says against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high or in heavenly places. Now that's the whole theme of the whole Bible. Here is this great apostle in the first century A.D. reminding these people at Ephesus that this is what you've got to fight against. But the Bible at the very beginning, in the 3rd chapter of the book of Genesis, it says exactly the same. Creation in chapters 1 and 2, paradise, men in the garden, no struggle, no difficulty, picking the fruit, holding communion with God, living an idyllic and a perfect life. But then, well, how have things become as they are? It's all in chapter 3. The devil, the entry of evil, all this that is summed up here so amazingly, wiles of the devil, principalities, powers, rulers of the darkness of this world, spiritual wickedness, even in the heavenly places, unseen forces. Here's the whole philosophy of the Bible, if you like. Its whole explanation of the state of the world. This, you see, is why we've had two world wars. This. Not statesmen. It's what's behind statesmen. Not countries and governments and manipulations. No, no. It's what's at the back of it all, this unseen element, which the world knows nothing about. Which nothing knows anything about except this book, except this message. This is a part, you see, of the mystery. Oh, let me put it in a phrase. It's a biblical phrase. The mystery of iniquity. The mystery of iniquity is the first statement of the mystery of the gospel. Why is there need of a gospel? Because of the mystery of iniquity. Well, now, this is more or less what we are taught concerning this, that before God had made men, he had made certain bright angelic beings to be his servants, great hosts of them. And then we read and understand that one of them, one of the brightest, raised himself up against God in jealousy and envy. He wanted to be ruler. Why should he be subservient to God? He rebelled. And a number of angels like himself agreed with him, and they followed him, and they fell. Before the creation of men, there was what you may call, if you like, a pre-cosmic fall. That's the teaching of the Bible. So that when man comes on the scene, there is this other power, this other element that comes in and tempts him. And men in his folly listened to the tempter. The tempter put to men the very thought that he'd had himself, antagonism to God, rebellion against God. And men listened, and men fell. Now I have to go on repeating this. Because, you see, without this you can't understand the mystery of the gospel. This is a part of the whole mystery. And the result of men's fall has been that man has remained in this state of antagonism to God. But unfortunately, at the same time, he has become the slave of the devil and the slave of sin. We have a struggle, says Paul, not against flesh and blood. We've got it there. We've got weakness and evil in ourselves. But over and above, there is this unseen, malign spiritual influence. The devil and all his fallen angels, his followers, these are the principalities and powers, the rulers of the darkness of this world. Now, there it is. According to the Bible, the world is being governed by these evil powers. The devil has become the god of this world. Paul, earlier in this epistle to the Ephesians, in the second chapter, the second verse, calls him the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. And that is the sole explanation of the human tragedy and of the present position. Man has become a creature of lust, desire, jealousy, envy, passion, malignity. He whispers, he backbites. He's a cheat, he's a fraud. He schemes and plots. Nations do it, individuals do it. Nations praise one another, and while they're praising one another, they're spying on one another, plotting against one another, preparing war against one another. We've seen that twice over, haven't we? But the same thing happens in the individual. It happens between men and men, men and women. This is the thing that is so true of the whole of life. Man no longer is governed by reason, by understanding. He's governed by desire. He's governed by lust. He's governed by these horrible things that always lead to war in some shape or form. He thinks it in his heart, and there's hatred and enmity and malice and bitterness. He makes himself a wretch, and he'd murder others if he could. And then he sometimes puts it into practice. Individually, puts into practice as countries, and there you have wars and all that they lead to. Well, now, according to this message, that is the cause of the trouble. And in addition to all this, of course, other things have come down. Disease came in, pain came in, suffering came in, death came in. It would have been possible for men never to die if he had continued obeying God. But God had told him, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. In the day that thou sinnest, then he goes out to paradise. He goes to death. And so, all these things have come down upon the human race. So it's a world of pain. A world of sorrow, a world of suffering, a world of anguish, a world of war. It's become an evil world. But on top of all this, there is this great biblical doctrine that this is a part of God's punishment of the sin and the rebellion of men. It's perfectly clear in the Bible. God has always said that if men does not obey, he shall suffer. It's written here in different forms right through the whole of the Bible. The way of the transgressor is hard. It always has been. It always will be. It says it like this. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. It doesn't matter how clever your wicked may be. It doesn't matter how wealthy. It doesn't matter how prosperous. It doesn't matter how affluent. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. That, to me, has always been the message of August the 4th, 1914. You look at the early years of this century. Look at the self-contentment, the affluence, the peace, the beginning, the dawning of this great 20th century. Oh, how wonderful it was going to be. Man mastering everything. Master almost of the universe, he thought. And suddenly there came that unexpected war. And what it proved was that this idea that you could have peace and be wicked at the same time was the most foolish of all the illusions of fallen men. God proves the Bible. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. But then they said, this is the war to end war. We're going really to deal with it this time. Now we're really going to outlaw war. We're going to have a land fit for heroes to live in. And we're going to have a League of Nations. There'll never be another war. We're really going to do it. And then came September the 3rd, 1939, with the same message. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. A nation, or all the nations that think they can go on in rebellion against God and yet have peace, are trying the impossible. It can't happen. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. There will be, there shall not be. This is a part of God's punishment upon sin. God asserting his Godhead, his sovereignty over all, that he is the ruler of the universe. Well now, this is as true tonight as it has ever been. Well now, there's the first statement of the gospel with regard to this whole problem of man and God's relationship to the world. There is no understanding of Remembrance Sunday. There is no understanding of the history of this century, the history of all the previous centuries, no understanding of the situation tonight, except in the light of this biblical teaching. The world doesn't know about it. It's a mystery to it. It doesn't understand it. The world thinks in terms of politics and politicians and statesmen and activities and conferences. It's doing it as much as it's ever done, but it's always been doing it. And yet it always ends in the same way. The mystery of iniquity. There's the first statement. But come to the second. This brings us more to the heart of the problem. The mystery of God's attitude towards all this. And here is the point, of course, at which man shows his ignorance most of all and is completely baffled by the mystery of God's ways. He shows this, as I said just now, by the questions he puts, by the statement he makes. Here are some of them. If God, as you claim, is all-powerful, why then does he allow pain? Why does he allow suffering? Why does he allow war? That's it, isn't it? If God is God, and you postulate that he's all-powerful, that he can do anything he likes, and that he's a God of love, very well, how, why does he allow these things to happen? I'm sure many have put that question themselves. This is the real mystery of God's relationship to this world and the things that are happening to it. What's the answer? Well, I've already been giving the answer partly. I have suggested to you that all these problems, pain, suffering, yes, the spastics, they're so often quoted, the spastics. Many people have told me, I look at a spastic, I cannot believe in God. Contradiction, impossible. An all-powerful God allowing that. Spastics, pain, suffering, disease, anguish. I say the first answer is that it's men who's produced all that. There'd have been nothing like that if men had obeyed God. Nothing at all. All this has come in because of men's original rebellion and disobedience. All this is to be traced directly and immediately to sin and evil and man in his folly listening to the devil. Very well, then, there is the first part of the answer, but I don't stop at that. The Bible takes us further and tells us this. And this is where we are face to face with this great mystery. That God in his eternal wisdom has permitted this. That's the way to put it. God has permitted it. And people are perplexed by this. And this is where they show the contradictoriness of their position. There is nothing that modern man argues for more than free will. Free will. He doesn't like a gospel that seems to him to deny free will. He holds on to free will above everything else. Very well, so the answer, my friend, to the problem of evil and of sin and of suffering and of war is this, that the devil had free will. And Adam had free will. It was a part of the devil's original perfection, as it was a part of Adam's original perfection, to have free will. And the devil and Adam exercised their free will and chose to rise in rebellion against God. So the thing that has produced all our calamities and troubles is the free will that modern man is so keen on and which he wants to hold on to at all costs. God, as a part of this very perfection, gave this freedom of choice. So there was the possibility of men making the wrong choice, as there was the possibility of the devil making the wrong choice, and in both cases the wrong choice was made and was taken. And God, in his inscrutable wisdom, this is the point at which I can't go further. I don't know why God decided to do this, but he did. He decided to allow this to happen. He allowed such freedom to the devil and to man. The freedom of the possibility of producing the modern world as you and I know it, and have known it during two world wars. That's one part of it. God permits it. God doesn't produce it. He has permitted it. But at the same time, and this is what people can't follow and can't understand, the Bible at the same time teaches that while God permits all this, he also controls it. And he's over it all. Even the devil hasn't all power. There are bounds even to the activity of the devil. God has permitted these things to happen, but still, even the devil is under God. God remains still over all, and he sets a bound to evil and to the manifestations of sin. Now, there's great teaching, in other words, in the Bible of what the authorities call common grace. It means this. It is God, you see, who ordained governments. It is God who ordained magistrates. It is God who has introduced to mankind various aspects of civilization. And all these are meant to control the results and the manifestations of evil. If God hadn't exercised this control, there is no question that mankind would have hurtled itself to final destruction centuries ago. But God, though he permits evil, puts a limit to what he permits. Now, this I could illustrate to you perhaps most easily of all in the way in which God has set a limit to the power of certain powers that have risen up against him. You'll find many of them in the Old Testament. You'll find quite a list of them together in the book of Daniel, Prophet Daniel. World powers rise up and defy the living God of the children of Israel and were threatening the whole universe. God allows them to go so far. But no further. Remember a man called Nebuchadnezzar? Here's a man who seems to have conquered the whole earth. And he stands up and he wants everybody to worship him instead of worshiping God. And God allowed him to inflate himself. Then one day God struck him. And he became like an ox in the field. His nails grew into talons. Hair grew on his body and he was eating grass like an ox. God made a fool of him. God humbled him before his own people. That's only one instance. Oh, read your Old Testament, my dear friends. Read history, and you'll see that God is controlling it. He's over all. He allows it to go so far, but no further. When it tries to go further, down it comes. Every dictator that has tried to be a world dictator has always crashed. We've seen something of that in this century. But that's God. That's God controlling. God won't allow this. God is still over all. In other words, a part of the mystery of this message is that God permits evil and yet at the same time controls it. I don't understand, you say. I've only one answer. You've already sung it in a hymn. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. Whether you and I understand it fully and finally is not the point. The point is that this is what we are taught. This is a part of the great mystery, and history, as I've shown you, proves it. But let me hurry. The next element in the mystery, the third and the last, is the mystery of God's way of dealing with all this. All this that has resulted from the fall and the entry of evil and of sin. And this is a point, again, at which people are completely baffled. Don't understand it. But it's not surprising. As Paul puts it there in the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Of course he has. What does the world expect? Well, you see, what the world expects from the gospel is a message of gradual improvement. The world thinks that God's way of dealing with the problem of men in sin and his diseases and his pains and his wars and calamities, they think that God's way would of necessity be one of gradual improvement and of gradual reformation. So it was expected that as the result of teaching and preaching, that the nations would use a little common sense and they'd banish war, hence the faith, you see, in the League of Nations. And to me it was so tragic to hear the Christian church in such a large measure preaching the League of Nations instead of preaching the gospel. And it's all been shown, of course, to be entirely wrong and mistaken by now. But still they hold on to these illusions. They thought that that was a perfect expression of the Christian message. I'm suggesting it was the exact opposite. Any message that says that this world is going to be improved is a contradiction of the Christian message. How do you make that out, says somebody? Well, I've already read to you what our Lord himself said as it's recorded in the 17th chapter of Luke's Gospel. It's quite plain. He says, as it was in the days before the flood, even so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. He spans the whole of history. You see, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the flood came. They were doing exactly the same until August the 4th, 1914. Wonderful, our German cousins. Plenty of trade, everything advancing and developing, wealth increasing, pleasures galore, everything you wanted. Eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the war was declared, and we had it all over again in September 1939. And my dear friends, whether you and I like it or not, we'll have it all over again. That's this world. There's not a promise in the whole of the Bible that this world is going to get better and better. It isn't. When the Son of Man is come, shall he find faith on the earth? Evil men shall wax worse and worse. There shall be wars and rumors of wars. Oh, I wish you say I hadn't come to listen to such a depressing message. But I thought that you were a modern man and that you want realism, that you don't want just a fairy tale. And now you're charging me with being realistic and wished I told you a fairy tale and made you feel a bit happy. You thought I was going to say, come along, we're going to make this whole world right. We're going to banish war. My dear friend, you mustn't contradict yourself. Face the facts, be a realist, and then begin to think. The world contradicts itself. It doesn't understand. And least of all does it understand this great and glorious mystery. And then the other thing, of course, that they're always expecting the gospel to say is this. Why doesn't God put a stop to it all? That's it, isn't it? This is the thing that's always said. Oh, they may put it like this. How often have I had to meet this argument? I'm not a Christian, says the man, and I'll tell you why I'm not a Christian. He says, I'm not a Christian for this reason. Your gospel that you're talking so much about and its mystery and all that you like to say about it, it has been preached now in this world for nearly 2,000 long years. And what has it done? Look at the world. Look at the two world wars you're talking about. Your gospel has been preached for 2,000 years, and it can't be true because it hasn't succeeded in doing its job. If your gospel were true, they say, then there wouldn't have been a war in the 20th century, and everything would be so different. Isn't that the argument? They say that if God is a God of love, he's bound to stop this sort of thing. I've already given you the answer. God is not going to force man's will. He doesn't do that. That doesn't mean that men's got free will, but God never forces men's will. That would be to treat mankind like machines. No, no, God takes you at your own evaluation. You say, I can handle things, I can do things, I don't need your gospel, I don't need to be born again, I don't need Christ to die for me, I can live my life, I can manage my world. Very well, says God, get on with it. Get on with it. If you think you can. God's not going to stop wars to please us. It is we ourselves who produce the wars and claim our free will as we do so. You can't have your cake and eat it. You can't have it both ways. No, no, my friends, that isn't God's method. What is his method? Well, his method is this. This is the mystery of the gospel. I only want to give you a general summary of it tonight. I'll have to take it in its detailed portions on subsequent Sunday evenings, God willing. But the main answer is this. God has got a plan for the redemption of this world. And that's the whole message of the Bible. It is a great plan centering upon a person called Jesus of Nazareth, which this gospel of mystery tells us is the eternal Son of God. And that he came into the world in order to save it. That's the mystery of the gospel. God's plan of redemption revealed in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The whole of the Old Testament looks forward to him. The New Testament Gospels describe him. The remainder look back upon him and expound him and his message. Here is the central message of the whole of the Bible. This is God's plan of redemption. This is it. What is it? Well, you see, it is revealed, as I say, in the Bible from beginning to end. I've already referred you to the third chapter of the book of Genesis, and that's where your gospel begins. The seed of the woman shall bruise the serpent's head. There's going to be a fight between the seed of the devil and the seed of the woman. But it's all right, says God, the seed of the woman shall bruise the serpent's head. The serpent has come in and has tempted men, and men in his folly has listened, and chaos has descended, and the world has become a living hell. I'm not going to leave it like that finally, says God. I'm going to put it right again. The seed of the woman shall bruise the serpent's head. There is to be a restoration. He tells us that way back in Eden. And the Bible is just the unfolding of that great plan and that great scheme and that great purpose of redemption. The Apostle Paul says in Galatians 3:8 about the gospel being preached of old in Abraham. Of course, the gospel is there in embryo, in suggestion, in prophecy, in your Old Testament. What is it? Well, I'm only summarizing it. Here it is. God is calling out a people for himself. God is calling out a people out of the mess of humanity. He is redeeming them in his Son. Christ came to save them. He saves by dying for our sins upon the cross and Calvary's hill. And throughout the centuries, God has been calling out this people unto himself, calling them out of this present evil world, putting them into a new body, putting them into what is called the church. And they're all being gathered and prepared, these people in all ages and generations and centuries, saving them from the final condemnation that is coming. Read the account of it in the Bible. When the world was destroyed in a flood, 8 people alone were saved. Noah and his household. All the rest were destroyed. There's this calling out that I'm talking about. You get it in one of the sons of Noah, Shem. He's the one rather than Ham or Japheth. You get it in the story of the Jews, this peculiar people that God is preparing for himself. You get it in the Christian church. Here's the message of the Bible. God speaking to the world, telling men and women that they can be saved, they can be delivered out of the ultimate calamity. Whatever may happen to them in this world, this is the promise. And then the other great thing that is emphasized in the Bible from beginning to end, and it's a most wonderful and comforting thing, is the certainty of this plan of God. Nothing can prevent it. Now, this is where the world is baffled. This is where the mystery comes in. You read your Bible, read your Old Testament, and you might very well come to the conclusion at certain times that God had either forgotten or else he'd lost his power. His people seem to be weak, and they're easily conquered by their enemies, and they can't retaliate, and they're carried away, and God and his cause seem to be absolutely defeated. Well, but as I've told you, when the enemy appears to be most loud and proud and arrogant and strong, and when he's appearing to be riding on the crest and the highest wave of his success, sudden disaster overtakes him. That's something you find repeated time after time in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and in the New. Here is the great word which the Bible uses to describe this. It says, in the fullness of the times, or when the fullness of the times was come. You see, it's like this, and this is where people are baffled. God and time. You see, if God is God, why doesn't he? My friend, my answer to you is this, wait. You don't understand. God doesn't think as you do. God's view of time is not your view of time. And that is where blind unbelief is always so sure to err. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. You think he ought to act now? No, no, he has his own time. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. He knows the end from the beginning. And thus I say, when all seems lost, he comes in and he revives. For 400 years before the birth of Christ, there hadn't been a single prophet or single prophetic utterance. There had been a dead silence. Then suddenly the word of God came to John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness, John the Baptist. And Christ comes, least expected, root out of dry ground. This is the mystery of God, and especially in this matter of time. And since then, in the long history of the church, there have been times when people have said quite confidently that the Christian church was finished and played out, that she was a complete failure, that nothing could be done. Suddenly God revives his work. And you see, he's going on with this. He will draw out his people until the fullness of the Gentiles have come in and the fullness of the Jews have come in. And God, the Israel, will be finally complete. That's this message with its mystery. But it doesn't end there. The plan of God, I say, is to call out in every age and generation a people unto himself. Men and women who realize that they've sinned against him and that they deserve nothing but what they're getting and infinitely more. And the amazing thing is that we don't get more suffering and pain in this world. It's what we deserve, but God is kind. But God has sent this message, and if we believe it and surrender and turn back to him and believe in his Son, we can be saved out of it all. Because it leads up to this, and this is the final mystery. The second coming of the Son of God. It's a part of the mystery of this gospel. That the Jesus who died and who rose again, and whom the disciples saw ascending into heaven on Mount Olivet, will come again, back into this world, riding the clouds of heaven, surrounded by his holy angels. And here's the mystery. When will he do this? People are asking that. When will he come? Where is the promise of his coming, they say? Look at the years. They've passed nearly 2,000 years since he was in this world. You've been preaching, you preachers, ever since that he's coming again. When's he coming? There's no sign of his coming. And they scoff and they mock and they jeer. But the Bible has already answered the question before men have ever put it. When they shall cry, peace and safety, then cometh sudden destruction upon them. That's how it happened at the flood. That's how it happened at Sodom and Gomorrah. That's how it happened when the Chaldeans came and destroyed the city of Jerusalem and carried the Israelites captive to Babylon. That's how it happened in 1914. Peace and safety. War with Germany? Impossible. When they shall cry peace and safety, then cometh sudden destruction upon them. In an hour that he know not, the Son of Man shall come. Watch. The great word of the Lord Jesus Christ towards the end of his life. Watch, he says. He shall so come as a thief in the night. When nobody's expecting him, suddenly he shall appear. And he will appear to judge and to judge in righteousness. The mystery of the gospel. Here's the greatest mystery of all. As the Apostle Peter puts it, with God, 1,000 years is but as one day. And one day is 1,000 years. You see, 1,000 years to us is a very long time, isn't it? Very long time. I remember that first Armistice Day so well, November the 11th, 1918. It seems a very long time ago. But what's that compared to 1,000 years? And people say, if your God is God, if your message is true, well, when's he going to do these things? Nothing's happening. The centuries are passing. 1,000 years, 2,000 years. Listen, with God, 1,000 years are but as one day. He belongs to the realm of eternity. You can't understand that, neither can I. This is the mystery of the gospel. The mills of God grind slowly, but they grind exceeding small. Oh, my dear friend, how mad we are to criticize God. We are too small, we are too finite, we are too puny, we are too warped, we are too sinful. How can we understand his ways? All I know is this, that the world deserves all it's getting and infinitely more. God in his mercy restrains and still sends his Son upon the evil and the good and causes the rain to fall upon the just and the unjust. Why he does it, I don't know. Why he blesses men and women with health and food and family and loved ones and friends who blaspheme his name, I don't understand. It's the mystery of his heart of love. But I know that because God is God, he's going to restore this old universe which he himself has made. And the day is coming when his Son will come back again, as I say, riding the clouds of heaven, King of kings, Lord of lords, surrounded by the holy angels, and he'll come to judgment. And all his enemies will be destroyed. The devil and the fallen angels and men and women who've ever believed in the devil and his message and have followed him and have gloated in it, they'll all be destroyed with an everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord. Every vestige of evil and of sin will be purged out of the entire cosmos. There shall be a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. The heavenly Jerusalem will come descending down unto earth, and paradise will be regained, and paradise will be restored again. Oh, you mourners, those of you who have wept in this century through the loss of some loved one or dear one, listen, when that glorious day comes, God shall wipe away all tears from your eyes. Sorrow and sighing shall be no more. There shall be peace like a river, and righteousness shall cover the earth as the waves of the sea. Oh, there is a day coming when men will literally turn their swords into plowshares. It won't be because there's a new government either in England or America. It won't be because of any decision of any statesman. It'll be because the Prince of Righteousness, the Prince of Peace, will have come again and will have destroyed all evil and sin and the origin of it all. And the whole cosmos perfected, restored completely, he will hand back to God the Father, and God shall be all and in all. This is the prospect to which we look, therefore. Then the end. The church completed. All thy chosen gathered in. with their king in glory seated, Satan bound and banished sin. Gone forever, parting, weeping, hunger, sorrow, death, and pain. Lo, a watch thy church is keeping. Come, Lord Jesus, come to reign. In other words, it comes to this. The problem for you, my dear friend, is not to understand the problem of the world as it is beyond what has been revealed. Your problem, your urgent problem, as it is the problem of every man ever born into this world, is this. What's going to happen to me at that great day? Everything God has promised has been brought to pass. He said he'd send his son into the world. He didn't do it, you know, for nearly 4,000 years after the promise. 4,000 years. But when the fullness of the times was come, he came. And God has said that he's going to send him again, and he will come. And nobody can escape that day. The day of judgment. When every soul that ever breathed will stand before God in judgment. Here is your problem. Not why there's so much suffering in the world, but rather, why is there so little? But above even that, what of that endless suffering, which will be the lot of all who continue to rebel against God and who refuse the gracious offer of his gospel, which offers pardon, forgiveness, reconciliation, entry into a new life, preparation for this glory, which is going to come when there'll be no war, no loss, no death, no weeping, no sorrow, no disease, no pain, when the paradise of God will again be restored. The mystery of the gospel, the mystery of God's ways with and God's dealings with this sinful world of men. My friend, are you still holding on to your little wisdom? Submit to the wisdom, to the mystery which God has revealed in the gospel of his dear Son. You'll have understanding of the past, the present, the future. You'll understand yourself. You'll understand life. Your mind will begin to span within the wisdom of God. Amen.
We do hope that you've been helped by the preaching of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. All of the sermons contained within the MLJ Trust audio library are now available for free download. You may share the sermons or broadcast them. However, because of international copyright, please be advised that we are asking first that these sermons never be offered for sale by a third party. And second, that these sermons will not be edited in any way for length or to use as audio clips. You can find our contact information on our website at mljtrust.org. That's mljtrust.org.